This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. On average, a college student has died every year for the past 30 years in a hazing-related incident. Last year, there were four high-profile deaths. Illinois Wesleyan University Greek Life Coordinator Elena Hill says anti-hazing policies are important as long as people follow the rules.
If you have policies put in place, but you don't have strong advisors, or the house has not been following those policies, that's the culture that creates that.
Hear how IWU and Illinois State University work to educate sorority and fraternity members to prevent hazing. Today marks Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson's last day on the job. You'll hear an interview first aired when he announced his retirement last August. And find out how the food you throw out may be contributing to climate change. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 30th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Greek Life coordinators at Illinois Wesleyan and Illinois State Universities are working to prevent hazing incidents through education. 2017 marked a particularly deadly year for hazing-related deaths. Four students died at universities in Pennsylvania, Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. And like the high-profile hazing death of Penn State student Timothy Piazza, alcohol was involved in all the deaths. The Pennsylvania State Attorney General's Office has dropped felony aggravated assault charges against Piazza's former fraternity members and brothers. The announcement in late February, however, left misdemeanor involuntary manslaughter charges in place. Elena Hill is the director of fraternity and sorority life at Illinois Wesleyan University, and Illinois State University's fraternity and sorority coordinator is Alex Snowden. He says even though best practices were in place at Penn State, campus culture won out.
Do you have a live-in advisor? Do you have a, is the house dry? Is your organization newer? Are you getting the education? I think what went wrong there is there was a campus culture that individuals gave into. And when you give into a campus culture and start to lose the way of what you were founded upon, you start to get to that murky water. And I think that's what ended up happening there at Penn State.
Elena, what do you think about the Penn State case?
Ooh, that's hard since I'm not the advisor there. I think, I would say this across nationally and being at different universities as a Greek advisor. I think that there are a lot of protocols in place, a lot of policies, especially in the last 30 years. I mean, even 40 if you want to go back to like Animal House. I think that it depends on the own organization's culture. And so if you have policies put in place, but you don't have strong advisors, or the house has, or the chapter, excuse me, has not been following those policies, that's the culture that creates that. So I think, and I don't know too much about it, but I would say looking at the details in that house and what's come out, I would say that they had a problem in their culture.
And so, yeah. And how are the cultures on the two campuses here in Bloomington Normal? What are things like at Illinois Wesleyan? How would you describe the campus culture?
Yeah, so we're kind of unique, actually. We are, all of our sororities are over 100 years old. Our Tau Kappa Epsilon chapter is the first chapter. It's called the Alpha chapter. And then our oldest fraternity is 152 years old, which as a Sigma Kappa, my sorority hasn't even been founded that long. So we have a really historic Greek community, which a lot of people, I think, haven't had that experience. We have lots of older alumni that contribute to our chapters, a lot of like alumni advisory boards. So as far as our culture, I would say that we still have alcohol problems just like other campuses do. But I think like the history there has really helped looking at our culture. We're really small too. We've only got 9 chapters, but we're also really big. We're 33% of the campus. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of support from the university. So I think for us, like as a private liberal arts institution, it's maybe a little bit different culture than some other big schools or even some of our other like sister schools that are private liberal arts in Illinois.
And Alex, how many chapters at ISU and how would you describe the culture,
sure. So
the campus culture?
We have 39 chapters at Illinois State. We have about 14% of the student population, or about about 2,700 students. We were founded, our culture was started kind of around 1969 was when Greeks came onto campus. It was a different time than 100 years ago when the groups were starting. But I think a lot of what we're seeing in our culture is a younger culture, a alumni just now establishing themselves. So they're starting to come back. You're starting to see more advisors. Because Bloomington Normal outsources a lot of their degrees, you're seeing a lot more advisors in the Chicago area and stuff such as that. But you're seeing more coming on. You're seeing more work. I think we have our issues. We have alcohol problems. We've got a lot of the problems that face most college students today, just at a different level because we do it at an organization level. But culturally, they're moving forward. We've got We tend to have higher GPAs than the average student. We've done a little over 120,000 community service hours, or 120,000 philanthropy dollars on average a semester to a year, 25,000 community service hours. So we've got a strong Greek community here at Illinois State that is continuously growing. We've got a new group coming every semester. So the culture is definitely ever-changing and ever-evolving, but it's a growing and strengthening culture on campus.
You mentioned alumni, Elena.
Yeah.
And what role do they play in affecting the culture? I mean, alumni might come in and have stories from when they were in the chapter and there was, you know, hazing, maybe people looked the other way. Does that make your job more difficult? Do the alumni help or hurt?
Well, that depends on the alumni or alumnae, I would say. For our sororities, I'll kind of talk about panel and council. For sororities, it helps a lot. Our sorority women have had, like, the same advisor for many years. They have a good alumnae connection. I've never struggled with any alumnae within the sororities. They've been really helpful with recruitment and kind of, like, the housing corporations. All of our sororities have privately owned houses. For the fraternities, it kind of depends. I can say, since I've been there, there's been a lot more accountability between especially alcohol use in the fraternities, and we've set up advisory boards within the fraternities, and partly because we needed to see more accountability from older members, but we're looking at alumni that are at least kind of like 10 years out. It's not like recent alumni that are on these advisory boards. And I would say since I've been there, I've only been there 3 years, they've helped more than they've hurt. Now, when you do have younger alumni come back to the tailgating at homecoming, that is sometimes not very helpful. But I would say the people who are invested in creating a successful environment for the fraternities, yes, they've been really helpful.
And Alex, same question, alumni, helpful or?
So our culture is a little different because we've got some groups that have alumni and some groups that don't. And so for those groups that don't have alumni, they've pulled a lot of their advisory and support from non-members to be a part of their team. So they'll actually pull people in that are, we have one advisor that's on the that's in the conduct office, but not an alumni of the chapter. We've got members that are in the visor center for the study center. We do all these different things with some alumni. I think for us, we've been focusing on educating alumni and getting them involved and getting them engaged. We started to see more and more come back to the table. From our experience, the problems we run into is when there's a lack of alumni. When alumni are engaged, those organizations tend to be pretty smooth sailing. They tend to be doing things the right way. So we encourage alumni involvement because even no matter when you graduated, alumni want to be engaged. It's just a matter of how you be engaged. Are you going to be an advisor? Are you going to be a supporter? Are you going to serve on a house corporation? Are you going to be a donor? Or are you just going to be someone there that can mentor a student or help them get to that next job? So alumni have this ebb and flow of where they can help when they can. And so I think that's the hard part with alumni is finding the right alumni in the right role.
You mentioned education. I want to get to education and prevention in just a moment. But first, the definition of hazing. And I think some people might be surprised at how broad the definition is for hazing. Do you want to, Elena, just sort of hit some of the high points?
Yeah. So when I think of like the definition of hazing, I would say any activity that's kind of forced upon to belong to a group, but it causes like harm, causes anything that's not safe for somebody. I would say it's different from bullying, okay, because some people will equate those, but it's very different. And I would say that the one thing in particular with hazing that I think some people don't understand is that it doesn't matter if you're willing or not willing. Any activity that's going to cause harm, that's going to humiliate, that's going to degrade you, even if people say like, oh, I wanted it to happen to me, it doesn't matter. It's still hazing.
And it's on a scale, right, Alex? I mean, mental or physical harm is different than what the definition says here, which is public stunts and buffoonery, for instance.
Sure. So there, when it comes to hazing, mental, physical, emotional, whether intentional or unintentional, just as Elena said, but I think the big key is is how was the hazing done? When was the hazing done? In what capacity was it done? Is it a matter of they went out of their way to harm these individuals, or was it they tried to educate them in a certain way that wasn't appropriate? And so that's where you decide if it's a learning opportunity, or sometimes learning opportunity is your organization needs to leave. It's time to go. I think that's where it's dependent on is, and where it's broad, because a lot of times these cases that are coming out in hazing that you're seeing in the courts and things aren't just as simple of, oh, we're making them dress up in a tie. Some of these are being attached to assault. Some of these are being attached to putting people at risk, theft, things like that. Those are intolerable things because they're putting people at risk. Whereas when you are dressing them up and making them wear a certain tie all throughout the day, that is technically hazing. But is that an educational moment? I would argue that that is something that you can educate them on. So I think that's what we talk about when we talk about a scale of, is it a scale of, are somebody's life at risk? Is someone being harmed? Or are we at a point where we can educate them and shift a culture because it's possible?
Fraternity brothers all wearing the same tie on one day, does that give you a red flag and say, well, maybe there might be something else going on here too, or not?
I think that raises us to bring it up to a question of them and sit down and talk to the people. It doesn't necessarily mean that could be the only thing that happened. And a lot of times when the argument that we get back a lot of times is, well, we are trying to teach them to be better men of our organization, and so that's one of our obligations. And our pushback on that is, well, why isn't the active members or the current members also going through that? Because as someone who would know the ritual, should be held to a higher standard than those that are learning how to do it. And so I think it raises questions. I think you've got to question everything, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it arose to something outrageous.
So before there's even a report or you see a bunch of people wearing the same tie on the same day, what kind of education and prevention is taking place prior to even getting a report? What's going on at ISU?
So every campus will do it differently because every campus has to address their campus culture in their way. From an Illinois State perspective, we do what's called hazing prevention online modules that we do through hazingprevention.org and Alive Tech, which is a company that operates it. Every one of our members has to go through that at the beginning of their new member process, currently all active members. We also do a program called Greek 101, which is an in-person education where we get to answer questions and we get to explain what hazing is and really let the students have a say in understanding, is this hazing, is it not? Is this allowed? Is it not? Is this education? Is it not? And so from our perspective, we figure if you're learning on your own and you're learning in group, you have a higher chance of understanding what hazing is, and therefore you have the higher opportunity of not being a victim or potentially putting someone at that risk, whether knowingly or unknowingly.
And Elena Hill with Illinois Wesleyan University, what sort of education and prevention is taking place at IWU?
Yeah, so we have what's called new member education, and there's three sessions of that. And the first session includes alcohol and drug substance, as well as hazing. Our second one includes bystander intervention and sexual assault. And then our third one talks about like alumni relations and like how to be a productive member. And so everyone is required to do that in order to be initiated. So we have about 200 students that do that every single fall. If we have new students in the spring, we'll also do kind of a little bit more of a condensed one with alcohol, drug, hazing, and then bystander intervention. And then we also promote programs. We have a fraternity and sorority programming board, and they brought in the fall a speaker from a group called Campus Speak, and it was specifically dealing with hazing. And then we also partake in, and I don't remember the dates. I think it's the end of September or beginning of October. We do a national hazing prevention week that we have our organizations get involved in. So there is a mandatory educational requirement for all new members to go through.
And what do you think is going on? Is there an upswing in hazing incidents in the United States on college campuses, or are the four fatalities last year sort of a one-year blip and we'll go back down to the one or two that we see normally in a year?
I think that hazing has been a prominent issue for many years, and I think a lot of it's coming to light because of social media like Snapchat, I wouldn't even say like Facebook, but Instagram. So I would say that. Is there an uptick? I don't know like individually for campuses, but I definitely think hazing has been a huge issue for many, many years. I know in my college days, like that was a rampant thing, but it was just kind of underground, so people didn't know about it as much. I think at Illinois Wesleyan, like, I, since we're a smaller community and I pretty much know all our students, I kind of know what's going on because I kind of think of it as Illinois Wesleyan High School sometimes. There's not a lot of secrets. So for our campus community, we don't deal with major hazing issues. But I would say that, like, nationally, it's always been a thing, but I think more attention is being brought to it. You have to remember, I mean, in the last, like, 30 plus years, there's been someone who's passed away from a fraternity or sorority incident, whether it's been hazing or alcohol. So this is not something that's, you know, brand new, which is so sad, I think, as a Greek advisor, because it's like we're dealing with the same problems year and year and year.
But you have a new group of students year after year after year as well.
Yep.
Alex, same question. Alex Snowden with Illinois State University. Upswing, greater spotlight on the issue?
I think there's definitely a greater call to action that we're seeing from the legislation, the nationally from university presidents, universities, umbrella organizations that oversee student affairs and Greek life and those type of things. I don't know the research well enough to say if it's on an uptick or not. I do know that there has been a hazing death every year for a number of years. And I think one thing that is coming from all of this is we're seeing stronger education coming from multiple ways. Before, the only way to educate was you had to put somebody in front of them. Now we're seeing different ways, whether that's educating the educator to train them to be the ones to educate, whether that's we still do the get in front of the students, but then there's the online modules. There's national organizations that have increased their staff to assist with bringing more individuals into help. There's also an increase in conduct offices holding people accountable for it. And so I think we're seeing a shift in education. So I think for right now, we're at one of the best times to probably be able to combat it and prevent it in the long term. But I don't think we will see real change in the next month. I think it's going to take some time to get the education to sink. And every school is trying to figure out the best way to do it for them. And then sharing that education with others so that they can do that as well. And I think we're all trying to get to a place where hazing is gone, but I don't think we're there yet.
Why do you think, Elena, that it's so hard to eliminate? Why is reform so challenging? One student a year, on average, dies. This year, last year in 2017, there were four high profile cases.
I think when you're working with 18 to 22-year-olds who don't have fully developed brains and they're coming into college wanting to belong somewhere, looking for friendship and fellowship, that for some of them, they'll do what it takes. And that's so sad, and that makes me feel like, should we be doing more things in high school to prepare these students? Because this also happens in athletics. Like, this happens,
and with marching bands.
Yep,
and with theater troops. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can happen in all kinds of different situations.
Yeah. So I think anytime you look at a group and you see people want to belong to them and be a part of that, I think that because their brains aren't developed yet, kind of the hell yeah part of their brains develop, not the critical thinking skills are, but they'll do what it takes. And it's sad because fraternities and sororities are not founded on that. And more often than not, and I'll only speak for Illinois Wesleyan, we focus a lot on the friendship, the brotherhood, and the sisterhood. And that doesn't have anything to do with hazing. And so I think that there's a combination of a couple things. If you have been to a campus where the culture since 1985 has been, it is hell week every single time during this month, this is what we've been doing for the last 30, 40 years. That's also really hard to get rid of. And I think, too, like I said, when people are willing to be hazed, that's also a problem because a lot of people think, oh, nobody's willing to be hazed. I can tell you that I have had students that in other universities that I've worked at, because I've been a Greek advisor for 8 years now, that would be like, yeah, like it's, I feel good that I was hazed. I feel like I was, you know, I showed that I wanted to be part of this organization. And that's always so sad because I'm like, that's not how you prove that, you know, you're worthy to be in an organization or that you should be in an organization. So I think it's like a combination of factors.
Anything you want to add about the difficulty when it comes to reform to eliminate hazing?
Sure. I think Elena hit a lot of it, but I think when you think about reformed, you're trying to tell individuals that believe, oh, that won't happen to me. Oh, we won't push it that far. And the truth of the matter is you don't know where someone is. You don't know someone's background. You don't know tolerance levels. You don't know what they can and can't handle. And so a lot of times there is that need to want to be a part of a group, and you're willing to do almost anything to be a part of that. And you sometimes think, well, those consequences won't happen to me. I think we're starting to see a change. I think we're getting a student that is pushing back on that. But in the end, you have to be able to give in and fight peer pressure. And that is a very, very hard thing, no matter what group you're trying to join. And to teach students, to give them the power to be able to do that, is what we're trying to do, is to empower them. And I think until you can get to a place where everyone on your campus is in agreement that we're just not going to do that, that's where you're going to face the largest struggles.
Does having a shared experience like hazing, or in the military, basic training to a certain degree, build bonds and lifetime friendships that are hard to achieve otherwise?
Oh, I don't believe that. And I can say this for a couple of reasons. And going back to what Alex said, there is such a thing as hidden harm. And you don't know what people have been through in their lives. And maybe they were abused as a child. And so when you yell at someone or scream at them or, you know, insert XYZ, you could be hurting somebody much more than you would even have an idea of. Because for some people, like, maybe they can have the crap beat out of them. It's not a big deal. A lot of those people who brag about being hazed in college, a lot of those people have that tolerance. I would say, though, it breaks trust. People don't know who to trust when they're in an organization, especially if you have like your new member educator or whatever that title is. It breaks trust within the pledge group or the new member class. There's different, you know, phrases for that. But I think that this idea that it builds bonds, that it creates this like membership of like, oh, we've all gone through the same exact thing. That's what new member education is about. Learning your history of your organization, learning the values of the organization. You can't tell me that hazing brings that to a closer part, to ahead of that. It absolutely, to me, is unnecessary, hurts people, and doesn't build trust like people think it does.
And Alex?
I think it's hard to compare this to the military. I mean, when you talk about the military is going off to war. There's
sure.
a completely different type of bond there, a different type of training. They're training for war. And so I think this is not the same type of environment of building trust and building a bond and looking at things, because there's different perspectives here. I do think that, could you make an argument that hazing brings a new member class closer? Yes, but usually that bringing closer together is out of fear of having to come together, because we fear what's going to happen to us if we don't stick together. Then you're building a bunch of resentment towards the people that are currently there. So you have that harm that's done. So instead of having one organization when all the hazing is complete, you in essence have four different organizations from four different hazing type experiences in the same organization. So actually you've fractured more than you've built. So can it? You could argue it, but in the truth of be told, it does more harm than it does good.
And the benefits of a Greek system outweigh the chance of a high profile hazing incident. I assume you both would say,
you both would say yes.
You talked about philanthropy dollars raised and service hours. We've also talked about the bonds without hazing that can be created as a result of this. You both agree that the benefits of a Greek system outweigh the possibility.
Okay, being, like I said, in Greek life for 8 years now, being a member of Sigma Kappa, I absolutely believe in fraternities and sororities. It is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to see students pass away, to see parents. But I do think that as we've moved forward, you see even international headquarters have like educators. They have people that do hazing. Like, we really are primed to have very great, successful organizations. Is fraternity and sorority life for everybody? Absolutely. Not. Do I think the positives outweigh the negatives? I do. But I'm not blind to know that there's major problems within the organizations and in the community. But that's where I feel like I can make a difference, and I can help our students and make sure they have a good experience and be safe.
And Alex, with ISU?
I would say that when fraternity and sorority life is done right, there is no better education, opportunity for gaining leadership, support academically, the ability to raise philanthropy dollars and to give back your time. There is no better bond that you will have with friendships. When fraternity and sorority is done right, it is the greatest experience one, in my opinion, can have. I do not think, even with the amount of money raised, the amount of time given, that you can put a price tag on a life, because that doesn't add up. But I do think that if you are a member of an organization and you are doing right and doing all that you can to make the experience as best way to make someone grow and become better versions of themselves, then the fraternity and sorority will always have a place here. It's when those that decide to go against that and do their own thing, that's when those problems arise.
Okay. Alex Snowden with Illinois State University, Elena Hill with Illinois Wesleyan University. Thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Elena Hill is the director of fraternity and sorority life at Illinois Wesleyan University, and Illinois State University's fraternity and sorority coordinator is Alex Snowden. Hill says there have been no hazing incidents at Illinois Wesleyan during her three-year tenure as director. Snowden says the last instance of hazing at Illinois State resulted in the suspension of Sigma Alpha Epsilon until April of 2019. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Normal City Manager Mark Peterson is retiring after 30 years with the town. He was hired in 1998 as Assistant City Manager and rose to City Manager in 1998, and today is his last day. He has a long list of accomplishments, including Uptown redevelopment. In this interview from August, when he first announced his retirement, Peterson said he's loved his job.
I'm fortunate to be in a position where I look forward to coming to work every day, and it's because this is a great community, and it's fun. We're doing a lot of things that are fun, and I've got a tremendously talented staff, and I want to, you know, much of my success goes to the staff. Frankly, city manager's one person, and it's relatively limited on what we can do as city managers, but our job. Primary job, I think, the most important aspect of our job is getting the right people in the right places, giving them the tools and the resources that they need to be successful, and then letting them be successful, get out of their way. And if probably as I look back, if there's anything that I'm proud, really particularly proud of is the staff.
I'm sorry, but you take a moment.
Sure.
And let me jump to the next question.
Sure.
Here. You've touched on this a couple of times.
Yeah.
About coming here, liking the community, the fact that you've served a long time. Your career as city manager has been fairly atypical when you look at other city managers. It's not unusual for city managers to serve a number of cities as city manager. Right. You landed here and stayed.
Yeah.
Why was this community a good fit for you?
That's a great question, Mike. Number one, it's a wonderful place to live. Who wouldn't want to live here? Great quality of life, safe, wonderful schools, great economy. In my case, as city manager, I have been blessed with outstanding elected leadership. The support that I've gotten over the years from the council members has been tremendous. They create an environment where it's fun to be here. They give staff the opportunity to be creative and progressive and sometimes push the envelope and do things that are outside of the box. Look at Uptown Normal. What a leap of faith the council took. We all took back in 98, 99, when that project got launched. And there were some very, very difficult decisions along the way. But the council was right there with the staff in lockstep. They supported us. And that makes, in a position like mine, that's rare. And so...
Never looked at other positions. Certainly, you were recruited.
Sent out a resume. Opportunities.
I
had calls. Yeah. Never sent out a resume. Never even considered relocating. You never know. Things change. Sometimes there's a change in political dynamics in a community, and oftentimes that occurs. A new council wants to have their own person in the city manager's chair. I understand that, and I defend their right to do that. But that didn't happen here, and when there was political changes, I was able to adapt.
It almost happened, though. with the last election. So had that election gone differently, with the difference in philosophy in terms of how maybe a town ought to be managed fiscally, right, or what effort they should put into redevelopment, would you have put off your retirement?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. And again, you know, political dynamics do change. Every election, there's a little different dynamic. You bring new people on the council, they have different priorities. And part of my job, the city manager's job, is to adapt to those changing priorities. Unless they become so severe, the change is so dramatic that you just can't make that leap. But I didn't feel I was in that situation here, so, and I have never been.
So no big goals got done that sort of said, okay, I can go. No, what about external factors? There have been some disagreements with the city of Bloomington. The climate to run a city is not any easier than when you started. There are some funding challenges ahead for all municipalities, including the town. External factors play a role, no, or is this really about you and timing?
It's timing.
Timing.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, yeah. There's always going to be challenges. There always has been. There always will be. They change, although they do change, but they also remain the same. And that had nothing to do with it. It was just, frankly, a matter of timing. I think it was the right time for the organization and probably the right time for me personally. As much as I enjoy my job and as much as I like it, I do look forward to some new things and some new opportunities. So I just felt it was the right time to move on, and the town will be just fine.
But you're the town's only second set city manager, right, after the town moved in that direction, that form of government. How much of Dave Anderson do we see in Mark Peterson's town management style?
Some. And first of all, Dave's a good friend of mine, and I stay in touch with him a lot. He's now moved out of state, but we talk on the phone regularly, and he's one of my mentors, clearly. I had the opportunity to work with some really outstanding city managers over the course of my career, and I think I've taken a little bit from each one of them. They were all different, had different styles. So certainly there's part of me reflects some of Dave Anderson's style, but I'm also different than Dave. And I think that, you know, even though I was an internal candidate back in 1998 when I was hired by the council, I think they saw the advantage of having consistency and kind of a smooth transition. But at the same time, they knew I was not Dave Anderson, just like whoever replaces me will not be Mark Peterson and shouldn't be. One of the advantages of having this kind of change is you get somebody different and new and has a different style. And I think that new style will serve to re-energize or further energize the organization and the community.
And you've worked with Mayor Coos the longest of any of the mayors.
Yeah.
Can a town accomplish what's been accomplished in the town of Normal with a mayor and city manager at odds with each other? Obviously, the two of you are a good team.
Yeah. No, I don't think you can. I think one of the crucial components or the crucial reasons behind the success Normal has enjoyed is the relationship not only between the mayor and the manager, which has always been good. We're always on, you know, we work hard to stay on the same side of the issue. We have disagreements, he and I. And it's great. I feel very fortunate that I can disagree with the mayor, sometimes, you know, pretty voraciously, and he accepts that, and vice versa. But at the end of the day, we're on the same page, and I feel that way with the council. I feel a sort of this great sort of a symbiotic relationship, and I've gotten to know the council. It's my job to know them, and I always feel like we're always on the same page. If that doesn't exist, it's very difficult to be successful, in my opinion.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Mark Peterson. Uptown Normal is barely recognizable from downtown Normal of 1988. Do you recall seeing Normal for the first time coming from Liberty, Missouri?
I do. I remember it very well.
And your impressions then?
You know,
quaint,
quaint, a little shabby in some cases, but with great potential. And it was very interesting. You know, I've forgotten some of the things. Every once in a while, I go back and look at photographs, and I remember like Rocky's and Schnebley's Garage and Model Paris and things that lot of people never seen. Abe's Caramel Corn. Loved Abe's Caramel Corn. Commerce Bank, Citizens Bank. A lot of those things that are gone, and many people don't remember, never knew they were there. So there has been a dramatic transformation and up from downtown to uptown, no doubt about it. I probably one of my most memorable experiences, one of my favorite projects, which what I call step one in uptown redevelopment, was the Normal Theater, which when I was the assistant city manager, that job, that task was put in my lap, and I spent, a couple of years shepherding that through the process, and that was a very gratifying project. And I think, again, I saw that as kind of the first step in the overall renewal effort for Uptown.
The second step maybe was the Marriott Hotel and Conference
Center. That was huge. The Marriott was huge.
And it almost didn't happen, right?
Almost.
And there was a poorly worded referendum that led to the majority of citizens saying, no, we don't want this project.
Right.
How did that end up coming to be?
Well,
short question, long
that
answer.
That was, I'll try to make this as short as I can. It was a very complicated project and a very complicated financing structure. And I will go to my grave with the belief that that was the right thing to do at the time, but we just could not effectively communicate that to the public. It came on them quickly. We didn't do a good job of bringing the community along with that project. We announced it one day, and people were like, what are they talking about? We had no track record, so that people were skeptical that we could pull it off. And for a variety of reasons, it failed, I think it was like 70-30 on an advisory referendum. And the council, I think, wisely stepped back from that project, but they never gave up on the hotel and they kept working. And then John Q. Hammonds came to town and everything changed at that point. And he was an amazing guy. Probably one of the most successful hoteliers in the country, if not the world.
Self-made.
And he landed here. And it was that's another story of how he got here. But the fact of the matter is he spent probably 45 minutes in our then downtown. I drove him around and he got out, looked at a couple sites. He said, this is where we're building. And he did it. He literally, it was that quick. He had this, he has a sixth sense when it comes to hotels, and that's where he built. He was initially going to be at Embassy Suites, but unfortunately, the footprint, the land footprint, was not big enough to accommodate an Embassy Suites because they're designed with that center courtyard. They take a bigger footprint. So he said, "I'll do a Marriott," which, you know, who could complain about a Marriott? And that was the beginning of a long relationship. Of course, John Q. Hammonds has now passed away, but I have great memories of dealing with him on this project.
Not to discount the Normal Theater, but right. If the Marriott hadn't fallen into place, what would Uptown look like today, do you think?
Wow, hard to say, but the Marriott was clearly a catalyst for a lot of other development. And I think it would have changed, but probably not as dramatically so. And then, of course, Uptown Station and the passenger rail service, high-speed rail, also was a significant catalyst. But those two things in particular are probably the keystone projects that paved the way to a lot of other private investment in Uptown.
What do you want to say about Uptown Circle?
It's the greatest place on earth. I mean, it was picked in some online poll as one of the greatest the greatest public space in the country. Now, it's hard to argue with Millennium Park and some of these other fabulous places and cities throughout the country, but it is a wonderful public space. And I think the water element really is what makes it so special and wonderful. So, and I have the opportunity to sit and watch what's going on in Uptown Circle right out of my office window every day.
And there's always something going on.
There's always something going on. Yeah, whether it's music, and some of it's organized music, some of it's just people taking a guitar down or a drum set, and there's kids. As I said, I think there's more ice cream consumed on that little circle per square foot than any other place in the country.
I did that weekend before last.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Uptown redevelopment where you'd like it and where you thought it might be at this point?
Oh, it's exceeded my expectations, but we're not done. I mean, in fact, the pump is primed now more than ever, and I think I look forward to coming down there 10 years from now. I think it'll even be a more dramatic change. I think there's tremendous potential, but we've come further than back in 1998 than I probably would have guessed. But it's been difficult. It's been challenging, a lot of hard work. We've fought a lot of battles over the years that many of them I've forgotten. And I've told the mayor and the council, we really do need to have a document this process. Because it's an amazing process for a community of our size to take on something like this and to see this kind of a dramatic transformation in a relatively short period of time. So I'd love to see a documentary filmmaker take this on as a project.
City Manager Mark Peterson is in the studio. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. The Constitution Trail was approved shortly before you came to Normal. The grand opening was in May of 89. It was 4.3 miles long.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the expansion and what the impact on this community maybe things we don't know about in terms of economic development with the trail.
I think it's now 45 plus miles between the two communities. Probably the single most popular public project that's been undertaken in my tenure with the town. And it was one of my first council. I think this may have been my very first council meeting or maybe the second council meeting when there was a key vote on this issue. And there was a last minute attempt to reduce the cost and make it a wood chip trail. Mm. They just put wood chips instead of an asphalt surface. And I believe it was a split vote, maybe 5-2 or 4-3. It was a close vote to go forward with the project. And there were some people that did not like it. I remember we have potholes to fill. We don't need to spend money on this frivolous trail. We had homeowners along the trail that were very concerned about safety issues that the trail might create for them personally.
Go ahead.
But the day the trail was done, literally, I mean, days after it was completed, the complaints were this: it's not wide enough, it's not long enough. and it has since then become so popular for every age group, runners, walkers, bicyclists, you name it. It is a huge asset for the community. And yes, it is an economic development asset.
So what lessons can a community learn from undertaking that kind of investment and taking that kind of risk on an amenity?
Well, Mike, you know this as well as anybody. We don't have mountains here, and we don't have
no coastline,
no riverfront. We have to create some of those amenities. Now, I love the prairie, and we have beautiful prairie here, and we have a lot of things to offer. But we have to probably be a little more aggressive than other places that have natural resources that we don't have. The trail is a perfect example of an investment. It's not an expense. It's an investment in quality of life, and ultimately, an investment in economic development and economic success. And I do believe that's the trail. In fact, we probably don't market it as effectively as we should to outside people who are looking to our community, to people who just want to come here and visit for a weekend and bring their bicycles and ride the trail. It is a tremendous asset for not only for our residents, but a magnet for bringing people into the community.
I'm under one of the landmarks on Constitution Trail regularly as a user of the trail, the Camelback Bridge.
Yes.
And many people maybe have forgotten that replacing that historic bridge was controversial.
Oh, my.
There was discussion of a regular straight bridge with the Camelback moved to the side as a pedestrian bridge, all kinds of options. The town did the right thing?
Oh, absolutely. But I remember it. It was a very controversial issue, and there was very few people who had no opinion. You were either for saving the bridge and restoring the bridge or against it. Let's tear this old, problematic, unsafe bridge down and put in a modern structure. I think what the town did ultimately is we replaced the bridge using a similar design to the original, but with some modifications to take into account modern day standards. We widened it. We lowered the hump a little bit to make it a little safer. We did some other things to improve the safety and functionality of the bridge, but we retained the basic character of this lovely wooden bridge.
It was a compromise? Is that what you're saying?
It was a compromise. Believe it or not, it was a compromise.
Does that still happen?
And there were still people that were upset. But again, once it was done, I think even people who were not happy with the plan said, yeah, that's not too bad. And now, of course, people wouldn't dream of removing that bridge. It's iconic in our community. We've just recently, our Parks Department has done some lovely landscaping work underneath the bridge, and it's created a real nice amenity for the trail. It's one of those little community assets that, thank goodness, that our elected leaders at the time had the foresight to say, we can't let this go because this is a treasure. And I look back at other things. The Normal Theater is an example. That was controversial. There were people that thought that's a waste of money. But the leaders at the time, Paul Harmon, kind of led the charge. And thank goodness they did that. I look at the Broadview Mansion that the town entered into an agreement. That could be gone. What a treasure. And we've lost so much over the years. But I'm so gratified that our elected leaders have that long-term vision. They understand, it's going to cost us a little money, but this is something we need to save. And Sprague Service Station, 305 Pine, I think is another example. Yes, it did cost some money, but this is an investment in the quality of life of our community and also an investment in the economic success of our community.
Mark Peterson's 30-year run with the town of Normal is done. He's retiring. He plans a bit of consulting, but no full-time work, and he's leaving for a cruise with his wife very soon. That interview was from August of 2017 when he announced his retirement. Assistant City Manager Pam Reese was selected to replace Peterson after a national search. Thursday night, the council and town honored Peterson by renaming the plaza between the Children's Discovery Museum and Uptown Station the Mark R. Peterson Plaza. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. NPR One is ready when you want to listen.
It is a constant in my life.
Discover a new podcast picked just for you. Catch up on NPR and GLT News.
The touch of my finger will get me to my local and national news.
Share what you like. Skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
I'm DeKeesa Pena from Bloomington, and I love NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at WGLT.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial, where your path to a bright financial future starts with taking a few simple steps today. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions might be sitting in your garbage right now. And it's probably what you're probably not what you're expecting. IPR's Miranda Corbett shows us how the food we throw out every day might be contributing to climate change.
It's 6 p.m. in the Knox College cafeteria. Students are shuffling through the buffet lines, finding seats with their friends, ordering milkshakes. It's the only cafeteria on campus, which means 1,400 students eat three meals here 7 days a week. This is one of the busiest times of day. Students are crowding around dozens of gray speckled tables that look like they came straight out of the 80s. Despite the tables, the rest of the cafeteria looks sleek and new, including the silver block lettering that spells out the cafeteria's official name, the Hard Knox Cafe. In about an hour, most of the crowds will filter out. The only sign left of the dinner rush will be the dozens of plates and cups stacked on a long conveyor belt that leads to the dish room. And looking at the plates stacked in the conveyor belt, it's obvious that not every plate is empty. Sometimes there's just a couple green beans and an orange peel left. Other plates have entire chicken breasts or even full slices of pizza just abandoned. In November, a student organization at Knox recorded just how much food students left uneaten on their plates. They measured about 100 pounds of food left over during lunch and dinner one day. 100 pounds might not sound like much, but that's 21,000 pounds per year. That means each Knox student is wasting 15 pounds of food in the cafeteria. Merrill Davis thinks that's a big deal. Davis is the president of the Food Recovery Network, the organization that counted how much food students left on their plates. She says students might leave food on their plate because they just take too much.
If you take that huge portion and figure out that it's super salty and something else is wrong with it, whatever, you've wasted a huge amount of food, a huge amount of resources on so many different levels.
Davis says Knox used to compost the wasted food, over 90% of it. But she says the dehydrator broke about a year ago, so that program was halted. For now, wasted food is going to a landfill. The organization she runs aims to reduce a different type of food waste in the cafeteria. They take food from the kitchen that was cooked but never actually served to students and deliver it to local nonprofits. Davis says they saved over 13,000 pounds of food last year. But food waste isn't just an issue on college campuses. It's a global one.
And if you wanted to think about food waste in terms of a country, so if we put all of the food into political borders, the food waste country would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases.
That's Heather McElvain-Newsad. She's a professor of anthropology at Western Illinois University. She says discarded food from kitchens or grocery stores produces methane when it reaches landfills. She says that's a problem because methane is a really powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. She thinks individuals can make choices to reduce their food waste.
It's something that people could very simply change by changing their habits.
To cut down on her own waste, McElvain-Newsad says she plans her meals at the beginning of each week. When she goes to the grocery store, she buys only what she needs to make those meals. But not all consumers are so proactive when it comes to cutting their waste. Martin Heller says buying too much food can be a difficult habit to break. Heller is a research specialist for the Center for Sustainable Systems at University of Michigan. A lot of his research examines the environmental impact of the food system in the United States. He says our food system is inefficient. We produce more food than we need. That's part of the reason why so much food goes to waste. He also says certain diets impact the environment more. People with the most harmful diets tend to be consuming a lot of meat.
Reducing our meat consumption, especially ruminant meat consumption, so beef and lamb, can have very large impacts on the greenhouse gas emissions associated with our diet.
Heller says raising livestock takes a lot of resources. Throwing out meat means throwing out those concentrated resources. He says ruminant animals, like cows, can produce a lot of methane due to how they digest food. Heller doesn't think people need to cut meat completely out of their diets. He says moderate reductions can make a big difference. But he thinks creating policy about this would be difficult. Heller thinks instead this is a change that can be made by consumers. He says he's trying to get other researchers involved in studying how to influence people to make these changes.
But you can choose every day what you put into your body, what you choose to buy at the grocery store. And those differences can have an impact.
Heller says people who feel powerless in stopping climate change can make household changes, like eating less meat, shopping smarter, and plating smaller portions that actually make a difference in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Back in the Knox College cafeteria, the Food Recovery Network held another campaign to weigh food waste. For three consecutive days in January, students sorted their food waste into large, clear bins. Around 100 pounds of food was wasted each day. That's nearly the same as they found in November. President Merrill Davis thinks these findings will resonate with some students.
Some people think, oh, wow, like that is a lot. What can I do to change it?
But she says other students are getting frustrated with weighing their waste. Davis says some say they feel guilty when they see how much they're wasting. And some students still seem to not care. She hopes these students will consider the environmental impact of their food waste the next time they take a large portion of food that they end up not eating. I'm Miranda Corbett.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And let us know what you think of the show. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.